you're listening to The Limitless, the podcast between. I'm Jason Horsley, and this week I'm talking to Nina Power. So let's start with your new book, because that just seems like a nice, easy, it just came out.
It's actually a little bit delayed because of the unmentionable.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's coming out soon, like in June, from Morbid Books.
Right. So. It's in the form of a letter, very, very personal. It's a very shockingly personal.
Do you think it's too honest?
There's no such thing.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's people get uncomfortable with honesty, so there is a subjective threshold. There's also the honesty, or the truth can be used in a way that's aggressive or, you know, hurtful to others, so there's that. But of course, I don't know anything about the behind the scenes of this. Could be an artful work of fiction, but certainly it reads very convincingly like a excruciatingly personal correspondence on one side of it.
I would say so. I think at the time it felt like the only thing I could do in that sense was to write this strange text. And I didn't intend actually for it to do or go anywhere in particular, but I sent it to my friend Lewis, who runs Morbid Books, and he decided that he wanted to put it out. But I think it does, because I've written some very personal things in public about, you know, various things that have happened to me in terms of like addiction and various controversies and so on, I have a kind of interest in the direct or the personal. It doesn't hurt me. I see it as a kind of strange form of strength, in fact, to, in a way, be able to disclose everything, as it were, and then to like reside with the kind of nothing that's sort of left over in one's life. In a strange way, I feel it as a kind of like protection, actually, this kind of almost too personal, confessional mode of writing.
I guess we have that in common then. Mm-hmm. I began it with Seen and Not Seen, not that I wasn't an exhibitionist before that. Something came to mind that I said to my brother Sebastian one point around this, which was that by exposing myself completely, I could erase myself.
Mm.
And I'm not, I mean, I kind of know the context in which I said that back then. It was more of a kind of castanading, erasing personal history sort of thing. If I just put it all out there, I'll no longer be attached to it. So it'll become everybody's story and not just, and no longer my story. Something like that. And now I'd see it probably quite a lot differently, but probably with that element in there too. But certainly, yeah, I do feel that way about the best protection is relinquishing the need to feel protected.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, also to mark a certain point, I mean, whether it's like a question of a certain kind of almost like ego dissolution in a certain way as well. I mean, there were certain things I wanted to reckon with, you know, whether it be things I'd said or done or didn't remember saying or doing when I was, really heavy drinker, for example, or I don't know, various contexts that seems to have shifted in the kind of art world and the London left and various kind of worlds that I was part of and sort of fell out of favor with, in a way to just, you know, in the face of various people writing whatever they wanted about me, you know, to say, well, look, just to add to like the story, you know, I mean, I don't know why people were so interested, but, you know, people love gossip. And so it was, yeah, I don't know. It was a kind of like, you know, saying you can say whatever you like about me. Like, you know, it really doesn't matter. Like, here is my contribution to your story.
So it's a personally directed as well as being personally written.
Yeah, I mean, I think the book you're talking about, I mean, there are several things. Like, I wrote a kind of various like confessional pieces like a while back. I mean, this text is obviously much more like specifically directed to one person. But I think it's also, I mean, there's a sense in which it's about what it means to perhaps be in love with someone who doesn't love you. Doesn't love you back in a certain way. And I think there's something probably that most people can relate to in that experience.
I think so, of course. It does see again, it seems like the most, and maybe I don't know about the most, but certainly one of the most, if probably the most, kind of exposing and vulnerable positions to allow oneself to be seen in.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's a kind of humiliation to it, perhaps, and I suppose I'm quite interested in admitting various forms of sacrifice or self-sacrifice or submission or, you know, in a way to be the kind of loser and to stay in that position. I think, you know, I'm so sick of this kind of idea that we have to be successful or, you know, I mean, I write a lot about feminism and I'm very, very critical of a certain kind of, you know, boosterish, affirmative feminism. You know, I'm only really interested in the kind of freedom to fail, you know, to not be a success in any way. I think in a way that if feminism means anything, and actually Simone de Beauvoir argues this in the 40s, that like from an existential point of view, the freedom to fail and to lose and to in a way not achieve any of the things that, you know, might be expected of you or one expects of oneself, is actually paradoxically or perversely, you know, the greatest freedom in a certain way. So yeah, and I'm very interested, I mean, like, you know, this question of sacrifice and what it means to even embrace the position of the martyr or the scapegoat. In a social situation or in a personal or emotional situation as well. And I think there is a kind of taboo in some ways around talking about that. But I see that position also as a kind of strength, a strange way, like when you've got nothing left to lose, you know, you're actually incredibly powerful.
Man without hope is the man without fear. It's in the Daredevil comic that I loved when I was a teenager. Frank Miller, in this case, the woman. Gosh, there's a lot of angles here. I'm going to be able to have to pick one. So the last one that occurred to me, we talk about scapegoat, is what you're describing there. The power of the scapegoat, the power of the victim. Seems as though there's a shadow side to what I trust and intuit and observe that you're doing and maybe I'm doing, like embracing that danger, like entering into it willingly. It's Christian, actually. I mean, some of the things you were saying about the inverted values, they seem quite Christian to me, like failure in this world is success in the next kind of thing. So that was one thing that struck me. The other was this counterfeit that we are seeing more and more the illegitimate empowerment of the victim, like people who are using this the position of victim to empower themselves in a way that I would say is very narcissistic.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think there's this, yeah, great danger in some of what I'm saying, because it's true that I think our contemporary culture and a lot of the kind of punishment of this culture and cancel culture, whatever you want to say, is predicated on an image of the victim that isn't actually the victim, or it's like speaking on behalf of others, you know, this kind of like heinous position of invoking the suffering of like a group or an individual or something like this, like, and speaking and acting on their behalf, you know, in order to kind of punish someone else or other groups of people. And yeah, I mean, the kind of the capital of the victim, if you like, or the, I don't know, the transitivity of victimhood and what gets kind of valued. Yeah, I mean, I think this is, you know, absolutely a lot of what is happening. And then it becomes very, very difficult to talk about kind of real victims in a certain way or who suffers more. And in a sense, I want to say, like, everybody suffers. You know, even those people you attack as privileged and so on, I mean, like, suffer. You know, I mean, to exist is to suffer. You know, and it, this idea that you can kind of hierarchize suffering or invoke certain people's suffering against others, you know, is a kind of, like, gross kind of calculative, you know, capitalist way of thinking about, you know, the quantification of suffering. So, I mean, I think there's something almost kind of like, I don't know, amusing about assuming a certain kind of like nothing, position of the nothing or position of failure. You know, I'm very, very interested in Diogenes. He's my kind of like philosophical hero, right. You know, and because in a way, like his position on the outskirts of the city in the barrel or the water cistern, you know, allows him in a way like the power of the nothing. You know, he's the one who can criticize Alexander in the anecdote, you know, to move out of my son, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, to kind of embrace the minimal difference between like not desiring and being alive, you know, and doing it in a funny way, I think is kind of very admirable. And also, you know, to eliminate precisely, as you said, like the fear, you know, I mean, if people already hate you, you have nothing to fear in a certain way, because, you know, even if it happens again, it's like you've already gone through it. It's a kind of, there are various sort of initiatic models of sort of self of denunciation actually and social opprobrium that actually are kind of like precisely initiatic, like they teach you something very powerful, and you know, lots of philosophers have gone through various forms of denunciation that they may or may not have brought upon themselves, such as Kierkegaard, for example, arranged his own denunciation, it seems. And, you know, like that kind of experience, I think, yeah, it's why not do the thing that, you know, maybe other people are afraid of, or you at some point were afraid of.
Of all people, it just came to mind is David Icke, who I'm not a fan of, I'm sure you can imagine, but he went through this massive ostracization period when he was ridiculed publicly, and now he talks about it a lot as his, that was his empowerment, he helped him become who he is. So unfortunately I went to the sort of shadow side there, because I don't really think David Icke's a very good example. The other thing that I went to is me, and I don't necessarily want to talk about me, but I have to now, because you brought up Diogenes. And the first time I heard about Diogenes, and interestingly, Dave O'Shaughnessy had just brought him up in an email, and I've never read the guy, well, he never wrote, but I've never read anything about him. In fact, I found it very hard to find books about him. But the first time I heard about Diogenes was after I disinherited my Horsley family fortune. So this is a living example of what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Because of heartbreak, because of being in love with a woman who didn't reciprocate. And I'd made this oath to the gods, if I can't have this woman, I will die, thinking that the gods would swoop to my rescue and make sure I could have the woman because I was too important to their plans. Well, of course, you know, the gods don't work that way, so the woman wouldn't have me anyway. So I thought, oh my god, I've made this oath now, what am I going to do? I can't kill myself, I don't believe in that. So I came up with the next best option, which was disinherit my fortune and vanish from the face of the earth. And it had this certain appeal to it in the very context of what we're talking about, face your fears and all that. Anyway, so I ended up in Morocco with no money, and one Moroccan some months in took me under his wing somewhat, and he kept talking about this guy Eugene, and he'd tell me these stories about Eugene, how Eugene went to see Alexander, or rather Alexander came to see Eugene because word got around and said, what do you want, I'll give you anything. And Eugene said, step over to the right, you're blocking the sun, and a couple of other anecdotes I don't recall. But I had no idea who he was talking about, just this guy Eugene. Obviously he was back in the Greek days, but everything he said appealed to me enormously. And at a certain point, he said that I reminded him of Eugene. I was saying things like, well, if I can't find food, I'll eat grass, and and I was living this. I wasn't eating grass, but I was living this. And but the context it had for me was unbearable heartbreak due to rejection, and this was the only way I could emotionally deal with it, was by throwing myself into circumstances where the heartbreak would be in a much larger context. It would be much easier to deal with it because I was essentially dealing with all my fears simultaneously, and it worked. And with hindsight, it was very rash, and there was a self-destructive, self-sabotage thing in there, but there was also an instinct that I did need to self-initiate. And so I just went the traditional route, for a
Yeah,
man,
no. I mean, like, I totally get it. I mean, there's this idea in a kind of more psychoanalytic vein, which is like this idea of subjective destitution. You know, in a way, you kind of renounce everything that you value, in a way. You know, in order better to kind of work out what it is that you do want or you do desire, perhaps. You know, if anything, and you know. I think just to be present in the moment, you know, to sit in the park and feel the sun, you know, in this Diogenes way is like, you know, strangely an incredible achievement, right? To kind of, you know, reduce or eliminate anxiety, you know, is a kind of goal. And it really is like going through the nothing in order to do that, I think. Yeah, so it's maybe about a relation to time. I mean, anxiety is always about the future. It's always about imagining various different kinds of possibilities and attaching desire to one or more of them, thinking, oh, I want this person or I want this thing to happen. And, you know, then being kind of impotent in the face of that desire and then, you know, having this anguish around your throat, which is, you know, etymologically what it really means is this kind of like grasping at the throat, you know, and
Anguish.
yeah, anguish and this kind of, you know, as if you can't breathe. Whereas actually, if you just sit and breathe in the park, everything's fine, you know. I mean, and even if it isn't, it just is what it is. And yeah, so I don't know. I mean, like, partly this comes out of this, you know, breaking this addiction. Because really, I mean, the love affair of my life was this like 20-plus year love of alcohol, you know, which is something I love more than any man, more than any person. And really, you know, to lose my relation to Dionysus, you know, who I'd been worshipping in my own deranged ritualistic way for 2 decades, you know, was an insane loss. I mean, to think, oh, I can never drink again, I can never drink red wine again, you know, to and then this have this year of like crying, you know, like I had these crashing waves of like misery that just like, you know, basically they were analogous to the sheer amount I'd drunk. You know, I'd had these kind of waves of melancholy, these crashing great like things, and all I could do is like cling on metaphorically and think, okay, this will pass, this will pass. But that kind of turbulence that's created by like this massive imbalance, you know, and you have to pay for it. I mean, you know, it's a kind of yeah, I mean, to restore any kind of balance in oneself or even in the universe or the universe through you. I mean, you have to kind of like go through this sort of I don't know, loss of self, you know, this kind of feeling of, you know, absolute I don't know, like abandonment, I suppose.
That's a child imprint, sounds like. I mean, that the word that you ended on is abandonment, and I mean, sooner or later I'll get there, don't worry, because that's where I always end up. But it's very, I mean, I come from a family of alcoholics, and I mean, you're making me think of my sister a lot just there, because since she had a brain had a head injury and a brain injury, she's sworn off alcohol because it was certainly related to it, and I think she's doing pretty well. But I'm sure she'll relate to what you've just said, including the crying. And then in the case of my mother, she was an alcoholic her whole life, from my gestation onward. Like, she was drinking when I was in the womb. and in the hospital during my birth. These are the stories that were passed down. And there was a period, there was one point in her life where our life where I wrote to her this long letter. I remember at the start with these capital letters, huge font, saying "Stop drinking or die." And I was very, very aware that her drinking was slowly killing her, but my tendency tends to be premature or to see things that other people can't see. It was the boy who cried wolf syndrome. So I've been talking about the end of the world for 30 years, and now finally the world's caught up, and now I don't have to say anything. And in the case of my mother, it's similar. She did end up dying of stomach cancer, which I would say was directly related to the drinking, insofar as the drinking was a way to suppress the sorrow and the grief that she had from childhood onward, and that eventually metastasized into some sort of cancer. That's the short version. And she didn't stop drinking to the end, to the very end, even after Sebastian died, which you'd think if anything would have woken a mother up to the truth. She doubled down there and even went to his funeral and was drinking. And anyway, that's my story, so I could very much relate to what you talk about, because I've seen that, how hard it is, that frailty to to Dionysus, as you put it. So is this related to why you are interested in sacrifice? Like, do you see this dynamic you're describing as the power or the potential, the redemptive potential of sacrifice in your life?
It's an interesting question. I was thinking earlier about this, I don't know, like a desire for a master. I mean, I think in a way what happened after I stopped drinking was a, you know, the need for a kind of attachment to something, you know, more powerful than me. Like I still had the need to kind of attach myself, you know, that stemmed from the same kind of arrangement with the drinking, you know, which I was never in control of. I mean, there's always the illusion in the moment, you know, where you want to stay in the particular plateau and you never can, you know, and you're always kind of like falling down the side of the cliff trying to get back up to it. And I think, you know, but there was a kind of reverence and respect even as I abused this drug very seriously. And yeah, I mean, without it, then not only the kind of sorrow, but also the, yeah, I suppose the desire to latch on to something, you know, but maybe something that was also cruel, you know, something that was impossible, that could never reciprocate a certain kind of warmth. And I think, yeah, that kind of struggle for warmth is maybe, yeah, then the, you know, who do I pledge loyalty now? I mean, it's really the sun, you know. And I think it's, yeah, because in a way you can always rely on the sun. I mean, you know, okay, it will hide behind a cloud and whatnot, but you know, I mean, when we look at Bataille and his, you know, the role of the sun in his work, I mean, it's this, you know, enormously excessive force. I mean, without the sun, there is nothing. But it's not just that there is, you know, everything, but it's kind of everything and more. It's like this kind of unbelievable excess. You know, and in a sense, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to worship the sun. I mean, it sounds very like paganistic, and you know, I mean, the sun doesn't care if you worship it or not.
Well, is it worship or serve, though? Because those are not the same thing, are they?
Yeah, no, that's true. And you know, what would it even mean to serve the sun? I mean, it's a kind of very like odd idea, I suppose. But I think in terms of, yeah, like a kind of inhuman or non-human, I don't know. I mean, a form of verticality, a form of like looking upwards, you know, literally, you know, looking up. I mean, it's like more reliable in a sense than any mere human could be, or, you know, any man or any substance. And yeah, I don't know. This kind of blank indifference of the sun is something you can kind of like cling on to.
Okay, so now I'm in two ways at once there, because I was going to say that this could, have you thought that this could be an avoidance strategy itself? Because you've got this imagine the sun, it'll never let you down, like you say, so you don't have to experience the risk of giving yourself to a human. But then the last thing you said, well, the sun's indifference. Is the sun really indifferent? I'm not sure that's true either. I think the sun is very sentient, conscious, and very aware of us, so.
Yeah, you're right. There is a kind of like strange tension in what I'm saying. And again, it relates to the sort of like the slightly masochistic dimension, which is to say, you know, the cruelty and indifference of the sun is still a relation. Like it's I'm anthropomorphizing it and, you know, having a relation of kind of powerlessness in the face of it. But yeah, I mean, I think yeah, I mean the sun, you know, it's not indifferent exactly. But you're right, I mean it could be a kind of avoidance strategy. I think I'm very interested in this kind of positionality question, you know, particularly for women. Like there's even if you're a kind of mystical religious woman, for example, like if you're a nun in most religions, you're kind of married to, you know, Christ or to the church, or you know, there's a kind of symbolic functional relation to like a usually masculine or masculinized figure. And I suppose what would it mean in a sense to have no tie then, either to a mortal man or to a kind of symbolic man, you know, as a woman? Is it possible, you know, kind of structurally or psychoanalytically, or even socially, you know, to be kind of totally outside of those structures of hierarchy? And obviously there's a kind of huge cost and punishment for those kind of women who are like that, you know, whether they're witches or whatever, you know, that kind of, I mean, obviously witches might have a relation to the devil, let's say. They still have a relation to the man. It's just an inverted Christianity, you know, and it's the devil, not Jesus, let's say. But, you know, to break with the relation altogether, you know, to, I don't know, to live in the void somehow, is it possible?
Well, that's what I was trying to do in Morocco as well, because it's just cut off all ties with everything and everyone, which, as I say, it can be both. I mean, there was certainly some avoidance in it for me, but there was also the opposite of, like, well, who am I without all of these support structures, or what am I, what remains? And what remained, at least theoretically and somewhat experientially, was me and God, me and the spirit. And of course, it's impossible to say how much of that is mind projections and how much is real, but there's definitely a ratio. It's definitely not all the mind's projections. I felt very supported when I gave up everything. It was extremely hard, but I did feel the support almost immediately.
Yeah, I mean, Turner, the, you know, great artist, has this amazing line where he says, "The sun is God."
That was his dying words, I think. That's
Yeah,
what I
he's well.
have.
I think he talks about light. I mean, Goethe certainly does, or allegedly. You know, these are all kind of anecdotal, but yeah, I mean, I think so. And I mean, Turner was somebody who stared at the sun as well. You know, engaged in this kind of practice, which is generally not usually advised
Yeah.
by many people. Though I think you can kind of train yourself to look at the sun, but I don't recommend it, just to make that clear. You know, and I think that relation, you know, if you read Spinoza when he talks about Deus sive natura, you know, God or nature, or you know, Bruno talks about nature is God in things, and that idea of a kind of pantheistic or like one-to-one correspondence between God and the universe. And I think it's absolutely you can feel this kind of presence or aliveness in things. And I think, you know, like for Spinoza, it's not one or the other. It's not that like there's God and then there's created nature. It's like, you know, God is nature, you know, and that's really what he was trying to say. I mean, as heretical as that is, and obviously he was excommunicated, but so he writes a kind of double book in a way, which is both about God in the, you know, sort of official sense, and also God as nature, as kind of an immanent God, you know. And he has this funny line where he says, you know, if triangles had a God, it would look like a triangle. And that human beings have this kind of desire to anthropomorphize God and to think of this kind of, sky man. But actually, the vision of nature as God, the kind of, and he says all we can really do is map God, so like walking around a forest is the equivalent of worshiping in church, because you're mapping the mind of God and understanding how you are determined. There isn't any way out of determinism. You kind of are this node in this network, this kind of infinite network, and you're just a finite node. But what you can understand is your own particular circumstance. You can understand it better. You can understand the things that cause you harm and things that cause you joy, sad passions and joyful passions. And that's all you can do. You so every sort of, I don't know, I mean, calls it an ethics, but it's really a kind of like topography. You're like mapping how things affect you and coming to understand them. So he talks about different levels of knowledge. But in a way, yeah, you start in nature. I mean, you're kind of part of God. You're like a fragment of, the whole.
Immanence is not heretical, so transcendence and immanence is tr that's traditional theology.
But immanence without transcendence,
Yeah, well, was that what he was he trying to present immanence without transcendence?
yeah, you
Was
could
he?
say. I mean, he says, like he says there's only kind of one substance, and you can't even say it's one. Like to us, it looks like it's one thing, but it's kind of infinite at the same time. And
Well, definitely going to get into very abstract now if we're not careful. I'm just reading this book, Thaddeus Kaczynski, and he's a Catholic philosopher, and it's called Sacred Nihilism. Well, that's part of the title anyway. It's an interesting book, and he talked about immanence. The transhumanist postmodernist age we're in now is all about immanence without transcendence. And what happens is you get this the liberal religion, the liberal arts become the foundation of the new religion, which is an anti-religious religion, but because it's supplanting religion, it can only be defined as a religion. And in the similar way, it removes God, and then the vacuum is of necessity filled by human beings, by man, but not in a logos incarnation of Christ sense, obviously, but in this nihilistic transhumanist sense.
yeah, I mean, I wonder about the transhumanism project in a way. I mean, there's a kind of like deep Gnosticism in our contemporary world, the kind of like abhorrence of matter, the desire to kind of transcend, our bodies through kind of various forms of technology or drugs. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a sense in which there's a like a very a desire for the virtual, the desire to become an avatar or to become whatever you say you are. Say you want to be, which is a kind of deep hatred, a hatred that's sort of encouraged, I would say, of, of nature. And I mean, there's a kind of huge, like, war on nature, really. And I mean, if you start talking about nature in this way, you get kind of attacked really quite quickly, as if you're kind of denying some sort of freedom or liberation through these kind of transhumanist ideas. I mean, but a lot of these desires, like to live forever, to become immortal, are very ancient. They're very old thoughts and feelings, or to transform one's body so completely. It's a kind of I mean, a kind of hubris that is kind of central to humanity in a certain way. And if you combine that sort of hubristic and Promethean desire with the kind of mimesis, the fact that we live in, that we are very mimetic beings, that we copy each other constantly, and that we tend to don't we well, we don't know what we want, but we think we want what the other person wants. So you can create these kind of like contagious ideas that seem to become incredibly desirable, but often might be like very, very destructive ideas, like destructive of one's own kind of being. I mean, I don't know if I ever thought it was a good idea to be an addict. Like I doubt it, but I probably, in some ways, I rationalized it, despite the fact that it was incredibly destructive physically and mentally and socially. There would have been a kind of reasoning for sure that I would engage in, and it had to deny a certain kind of reality, a certain kind of physical nature. And I think it became a kind of nihilism as well. There's a kind of nihilism to that denial, like you don't want to face up to the limits, let's say, of one's own body, for example. I mean, not for example, in particular, one's own body.
Yes, it's a paradox in there. And I mean, because you mentioned Dionysus as well, so presuming that's part of the rationalization, which is the spiritualization, going that it's not, I'm not just putting toxins in my body, I'm connecting to the Dionysian current through my body. And there's something around here, whether I'll be able to articulate it or not, that the over-identification with the body leads to a rejection of the body. So, Because my brother, I mean, my brother had this whole philosophy of dandyism, which was all about I am who I pretend to be, and drug addiction and prostitution and physical forms of decadence and alcohol were all part of this. So it's as though he was trapped in the body in some way, and so and he literally got crucified, right? And trying to get free of something that I would say was in the body, and so. He became so this over-identification with the body. This is like there's only immanence. There's no transcendence. We feel our sacred essence, but it's trapped in the body. And so then we try and destroy the body to get free of it, and it never works because the body is the expression of the transcendent.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think if you look at John Locke, whatever, everybody sort of forgets about this kind of liberal philosophy is that, Locke talks about our bodies as property, which kind of we can think of then as our bodies are like marketable, we can sell our bodies, that they're kind of exchangeable in this kind of great system. But the thing that people miss about Locke is that also he says, our bodies belong to God. They're God's property, right? They're not only our property for us to do with what we want, right? In the sense that we can like sell our body literally or metaphorically, we can kind of chuck ourselves around and be self-destructive. I mean, of course, all these things are absolutely possible. But what I think we have is a kind of culture that's like Locke without God, in a way, that you just have the, exchangeability of bodies. I mean, if you read like Pierre Klosowski's book, Living Currency, I mean, he already identifies this tendency of the kind of exchangeability of bodies in a way, like they are the kind of absolute commodity. And of course, we can already see this in like in Marx as well. But yeah, I think the question of whether one's body as an image then kind of circulates online and it, the opinion of the other is what counts, not how you feel about yourself, but how the other perceives you, and this kind of hall of mirrors idea of like, yeah, what it is to be seen in this like heavily dominantly visual way. Yeah, I mean, it can't but cause, huge kind of like, I don't know, schisms in like the mind body relation. And like, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think the body is an expression of what one's inner essence, whatever that means. I don't think there is another thing hiding behind the body that we can somehow unleash. I mean, that's the kind of Gnostic idea to me. Yeah, we destroy the matter to get to the spirit or the essence. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a kind of spiritual dimension to flesh or, to incarnation. It's not purely like base matter that we're talking about. I mean, clearly there's all kinds of, I don't know, nuanced and subtle planes and dimensions to existence.
Yeah, I think it seems as though it's a creation of a false dichotomy or a polarity out of a unity. So a mind-body split would be the obvious cliche. And I was wondering if it relates also to talking about nature and there's a war against nature, but there's also now a war that's supposedly on the side of nature against humanity. There's a, these growing memes and movements and behaviors and policies and agendas. If we're not careful, we will end up on COVID-19 because it does seem to be accelerating a lot of this. That's anti-human. That's visibly anti-human. So there seems to be a split also in terms of what we think of as nature and what we think of as human nature.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, just on the mind body thing, I mean, Spinoza again would say, look, they're just two different ways of looking at the same thing, and the same would be, the case of like nature and human nature. I mean, it's absolutely a mistake to separate these two things. And I think the idea that something like modernity has like completely severed us from the natural world. I mean, people talk about the Anthropocene or the Capitalocene, and the kind of dominance of humans as this like apex predator and this kind of destructive force. I mean, no doubt that's sort of true in a certain way, but I mean, Yeah, the kind of inseparability of human nature and non-human nature seems an important starting point. You know, otherwise you end up in all kinds of like very, you know, dubious sorts of solutions, let's say. I mean, whether you go for a kind of hyper-technical sort of technological fix, you know, in which we're just going to keep making things in order to maintain kind of human life. You know, we're going to be like strip mining Mars and, or, you know, moving to Mars or whatever. I mean, I think these are kind of, again, like really excessively Promethean. I mean, they're interesting to think about for sure. I mean, you know, we have like the SpaceX program, we have like private investment in space travel, you know, happening all the time. And it, you know, there's a kind of very, yeah, I mean, in a sense, I'm not against this sort of exploration of the universe
I
for
am.
sure. Are you
Yeah.
okay?
Well, I try not to take positions against, but I think it's insane. I think it's really crazy. I also think it is another example of traumatic reenactments. Like we unconsciously reenact the things we don't want to experience or the things we can't haven't been able to process. So the split off from the mother's body, however traumatic that was, the split from our own body into these dissociative fantasy realms. That's obviously viewable in transhumanism, but even in, oh, what's that? What is that? Is that the AI speaking to us?
No, that's Laurie Anderson. It's because, oh my gosh, that's a really weird thing. It's talking about Superman. This is very appropriate to our Promethean discussion of space travel.
Yeah.
It's slightly bizarre. I didn't turn it on. It's like I have Spotify, which is not a great program, but whatever. And I gave my login to Lewis, the guy who's publishing my text, and sometimes what he plays on my computer because we haven't worked out how to dissociate the
Yeah.
two. So he's obviously listening to Laurie Anderson on
Right, God, you.
Superman at this exact moment. So I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. He made a cameo.
It was a very relevant cameo.
Yeah. So anyway, I think I interrupted you. Where were we?
No, I mean we were talking about you were talking about this this desire to dissociate, you know, the kind of you know, the astral temptation, I suppose, to start again, you know,
Yeah.
to kind of I don't know, in relation to like leaving planetary orbit, to, well, leaving the Earth, I mean, to kind of attempt to escape the thonic, you know, or the mother, you know, by launching into to space. And
And that's another aspect that I think we're all mother bonded in these unhealthy ways. So this is a way to try and get free of the mother unconsciously because it doesn't work. It's the geographical cure in the AA jargon. We take that our complexes with them if we just try and seek the solutions outside of ourselves and even replicate them. Of course, talk about mimesis. Well, mimesis has this other dimension, which is we're unconsciously imitating each other, but we're also unconsciously reenacting the traumas that were imprinted on us ancestrally. So that's an even deeper level of imitation. It's more like possession.
I mean that kind of question of like you know, stratification and that like the depths of these sorts of horrors, and the I don't know, the almost inability to escape repetition of
Yeah.
certain things. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, like there's, you know, a large amount of alcoholism in my family, and you know, in a sense, even if you know that, it doesn't stop you from somehow repeating the same thing, you know, as if, you know, why are you compelled to repeat the same error? They'd say, nevertheless, there is something there. I mean, I, you know, it's not solely genetic in that way. It's not solely a, you know, there's not a, I think I have this question of doom or fate, you know, like I have this one tattoo that I got as a teenager when I was reading Nietzsche, and it's the amor fati tattoo, the love of fate, you know, which is the Latin phrase that Nietzsche loves, you know, as if as a teenager I somehow understood this or accepted this kind of strange stoical position, which I obviously didn't. It's a very inappropriate tattoo in that sense for a young person to get.
Yeah,
Yeah.
we're not alone in that. I've got my regrettable tattoos when I gave my body to Lucifer. I said my body belongs to Lucifer. I'm going to stamp it with the official brand. Anyway,
Wow.
that's not stuff I tend to talk about. Well, I do actually, but
I just pulled the devil card actually, just before we came online.
oh, well, there you go. That's with the Horsley Street, the devil card. It's,
Yeah.
all the signs are rolling in. Well, maybe we should linger on the Lucifer things. It's certainly relevant in terms of sacrifice and redemption. My philosophy, or my reasoning with the Lucifer thing was that Lucifer required redemption, and that I would volunteer to sacrifice myself to be a redemptive vessel of Lucifer, so that Lucifer could make amends through me, kind of thing. That was the reasoning. And maybe we can tie this to what you were just talking about, this unconscious reenactment. Why do we do that? The love of fate. Because Nietzsche believed in the eternal return, which is very nightmarish, but then he tried to spin it, didn't he, by saying if you live the perfect life, then it'll be fine if you just repeat it over and over again. But I think there's something contradictory in that, because if we're constantly reenacting the same life, whether it's in a literal sense, like Nietzsche maybe believed, or in an ancestral sense, presumably I would say it's to resolve the thing that can only get resolved by seeing it in the full light of consciousness. Thinking of the sun again now, like when the sun shines light, the shadows disperse. So then we unconsciously reenact so that we can become conscious. But once we become conscious, then we're free from fate.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I read Nietzsche slightly differently in a certain way. I mean, I like as a kind of ontological claim about time, I suppose it's not really about bringing it to consciousness. Although, if there is a conscious element, it's a kind of test because it's, you know, this question of affirmation: can you affirm everything that's happened to you? You know, every mistake. It's, you know, there isn't a perfect version. In fact, it's like it's reliving over and over and over again every single pain and sorrow you suffered. You know, and the strong person for Nietzsche, then the question of strength would be the person who can say yes to everything. You know, everything that went wrong, everything that was terrible, every mistake, every stupid thing you said, every ridiculous thing you did. You know, it would be to say yes to it, because that would be then saying yes to life in a certain way. And it's a kind of challenge or a sort of test of, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could think about it as like, what do you regret, if anything? You know, can you affirm, you know, like in a sense, I wasted 20 years of my life drinking, right? From one perspective. And from another, I think, I don't care. I mean, I don't regret it in a way, even though it was terrible, you know, because to regret it, what would it mean to regret it? I wouldn't be here now. I wouldn't be this person.
Sure, and it tends to drive the same behaviors if we get
Right.
locked into guilt. But I would say that there's another factor here, because I regret all the psychedelics I did, but not in some moral sense, but merely based on a felt visceral sense of the damage it did to my body, and I'm still repairing that damage. So that's different from regret. That's just facing reality, I would say. And if I could do it again, I would do it differently. I'd say there's a subtle difference there, because at the same time I very much have what you're describing there, which is I needed to do it this way, and there is value in it because I've learned wisdom. That's the Blakean thing, the folly leads to the path of wisdom, whatever it is, that thing,
Road of excess.
the excess, yeah, road of excess. Well, but I think there's a real subtle thing in here, because that the kind of, I mean, Nietzsche went mad, so I never trust my philosophers if they ended up mad.
That I only trust philosophers who end up mad.
Well, I mean, I want to see, and it's very hard if we're talking historical figures. Diogenes, good ex he's maybe a good counterpoint, but we don't really know. But even the fact he didn't write anything speaks in
Yeah.
his favor, right? But if he really lived like that, and he really did enjoy his life that way, and he died, that just sounds like a great example of what I'd be looking for in my philosophers, is somebody who really did live a full, joyful life, not somebody who was pulling their hairs out to the bitter end, right? So that was a bit of a digression. I think the essential thing that I'm trying to get to here is that there is something about the perfect life, not as some awful Nazian goal or what have you, the will to power, as Nietzsche again. But I mean, not as so far as it depends on self-rejection, or even self-sacrifice necessarily, but that as we recognize and accept our traumatic patterns of behavior, and don't judge them, and don't regret them, and embrace them, they become neutralized. They become, the charge disperses, and so then we're no longer driven into those behaviors.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Nietzsche would talk a lot about guilt and resentment in the genealogy of morality, and both on a collective and an individual level, and he talks about the roots of guilt as debt, like as a kind of economic description before it's a kind of Christian and, sort of moral and emotional feeling, that it's something owed. And obviously Christianity, in a sense, is a religion entirely predicated on the fact that somebody has already died for your sin, so you're in a kind of permanent debt or sin state, right? Which you're kind of
Or
trying to pay.
debt-free. Well, it could go either way.
Well, yeah, it's true, but it's like if somebody has died for your sins already, I mean, yeah, I mean, either you kind of can do what you like, or you're kind of like infinitely indebted, perhaps,
Or maybe you just have only one model to emulate then, as
Yeah,
in.
I mean, the martyrdom aspect, let's say. I mean, your brother crucified himself or was crucified. It's a very interesting thing to do, in some ways. But I think, to live without guilt, without feeling that you owe something, or you owe somebody something, or I mean, I used to feel very guilty all the time, and I'd wake up and feel guilty in this very abstract way, in this kind of hungover way, and then I tried to expiate it through working excessively hard, and then I would, drink to reward myself or whatever, and then it was like this hamster wheel of the day. Every day was the same, basically, and it was really a just deep guilt feeling somewhere about here. And now I no longer feel guilty because, I mean, sure, I might make mistakes or upset somebody. I'm not saying I live without blame or sin. I definitely do things wrong, but there, it's a much more conscious relation to those things I say and do. It's, if you're kind of constantly inducing oblivion and, I don't know, actively destroying your capacity to live in a kind of cumulative way, you're very liable to guilt. It kind of like flows through you, because your actions and yourself become so kind of separated, and I think that's one of the interesting distinctions between like shame and guilt. Guilt is usually like guilt about an action. It's like you can't believe you've done that thing, whereas shame is much more fundamental. It's like, I can't believe I did that. It's something about you, like there's something that's kind of negative about you fundamentally, this feeling of shame, which is different from guilt. And I think guilt is easier to deal with somehow, than shame. Shame is, something absolutely fundamental. And I mean, I'm not saying people can't recover from shame, but I mean, certainly the people I know who felt the most ashamed suffered the most of people I know, I would say.
So, how much do you see in yourself, I guess, which is you're the only person you can refer to, the shame imprint as relating to your parents' expectations or requirements of you?
That's the thing. I don't actually feel shame. I don't feel ashamed of who I am. And actually, I think my parents didn't really have any expectations of me. for which I'm extremely relieved, in fact. Yeah, because I don't come from, like, I come from a very normal, like, family in the countryside, and they're not involved in anything kind of cultural or academic or intellectual, or, you know, they didn't really have any expectations of any kind. I don't mean that negatively. I mean, of course, they wanted me to be, you know, happy, I guess, but that's kind of it. It wouldn't have mattered what I did. Like, I could have, you know, stayed with them. I could have, like, married someone from school at 16. I could have, you know, my brother did these kinds of things, like, and it's not, I don't know, there's no value judgment or hierarchy in the way they see things. So, I mean, in a way, I think it was much more like properly existentialist, which is to say, like, you know, this freedom, in a way, this freedom to fail or do other things. It's purely, I don't know, coming from, I don't know, myself in a certain way. But it's funny, I do think this difference between shame and guilt is, you know, whilst I kind of messed around with guilt, or was, oh, that's too glib, but, you know, whilst I suffered from guilt, I never suffered from shame. And I think perhaps it's because there weren't these massive expectations from anybody.
I'm putting on my skeptical face now, because somebody who's 20 years alcohol, ick. I can't believe that you didn't suffer from shame.
I don't know. I think I suffered from coldness, feeling cold.
It seems to me that shame is pretty universal in our culture. And actually, to qualify, what I meant by the parents' expectations, and it was a groping question because I wanted to make it a question rather than talking more about me again, but wasn't social expectations. It was to do with, like, in my case, I know my mother, there was this emotional incest going on there. Like, my mother needed, wanted me and used me to make herself feel good, which is pretty normal for parents in the West, traumatized parents, to do that. And for mothers probably particularly, and then my father could have cared less. I mean, I was just like this dog he didn't want to be bothered by most of the time. So those imprints, like the heavy, sticky kind of expectation, emotional need of my mother, combined with my father's indifference, like a vacuum of expectation. Because no, I didn't have particular social expectations on me, even though it was a high power family. But I feel that I was very deeply imprinted with that, and that most of my life I've been driven to try and, like we were talking about at the beginning, really to try and achieve something in the world that would provide for me the validation from the world that I'm okay, that I'm not broken, I'm not dysfunctional, that I'm good, and that I'm worthy of love.
Watching Mama lying there with muffin seeds. She's got the color of the rain and electric dreams. Oh, forgiven. Whoa, nothing to complain. Your love is with me. Let's have a good time. Rock your bones with a suit, but the 80s fashion feels. Sparrow with a wind, talking pelvis sentences on your march. Ooh, isn't your time? Your love is with me endlessly. Let's have a good time.
set songs you dance while your feet are getting old. That will be a tomorrow where the heart's for your tenor.
I think, I mean, one of the things I suppose I did suffer from very, very intensively was insomnia. You know, my entire life, I had it incredibly badly. Like I said, averaged 2 hours out of 24 for most of my childhood. And I was, put on drugs at various points. And you know, it was a massive, massive problem. Like, it really caused huge issues. And of course, then the issue becomes, if you're kind of completely overstimulated all the time, people can't look after you. Yeah, they can't be around you. You have to kind of become alone, if you like, and be self-sufficient and, you know, entertain yourself, because everyone else has to go to sleep. Like, you're the one who doesn't sleep. So everyone else is asleep. So you're kind of like, by default and on your own. And I think, you know, then the sun becomes this kind of, well, the sun will be here soon, you know.
Wow. Was it? Were there as a diagnosis for that or an explanation attempted?
Not really. No, I mean, I think just a very overactive mind somehow. And, you know, I was like very hyperlexic and I read all constantly and just, I don't know, like a kind of problem with overstimulation. Like, I didn't, you know, obviously if you don't sleep at all, it's extremely kind of bad for you. And I mean, you know, there were states of exhaustion and kind of like oniric madness that I entered into as a teenager. And, you know, in a way, I think the alcohol, when I like discovered it at 11 and then properly really at 15, you know, was also about sleep. It was about this. It was like, oh my God, I can use this thing to create this blackness that I can't otherwise reach. But I mean, of course, the alcoholic stupor or the sleep induced by alcohol is like incredibly poor sleep, but you can trick yourself, you know, into that blackness. And I just couldn't get there otherwise. So, you know, in that sense, it's like a, you know, you become reliant on this thing to sleep, you know, and sometimes I would mix it like Valium, really crazy, stupid shit, you know, you shouldn't do. But to get that, yeah, oblivion.
Wow.
You know, because it's very lonely to be awake all the time, you know.
So how far back do you remember the insomnia then?
Like, all the way back. I mean, my earliest memories are like being awake and being cold, you know, and I grew up in a very, very cold house.
How young?
Like, I don't know, 3, 4, I suppose, you know. Mm. And I like slept very separately and like away from everybody else.
And you, as far as you know, there was no specific event that triggered this insomnia?
No. I mean, it was before I was conscious, it was the same.
You mean before your memories began?
Before my memories began, yes.
Because you were being conscious in the womb, so...
Yes, it's true, so but before you, I can remember.
Have you considered that there might have been an event?
Maybe. I mean, I think, like, my birth was like incredibly traumatic for all concerned, in the sense of, like, it was a cesarean. My mum had a hemorrhage and she nearly bled to death. She was saved kind of at the last minute, and, you know, it was very, like, you know, terrible for her, you know. And I think, yeah, I mean, in a way, she sort of jokingly blamed me for almost killing her, you know, a lot.
Wow.
Which, you know, isn't really my fault. I mean, you know, so I would always say, well, you chose to do it. I mean, you chose to get pressure. You know, it's on you, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think it was probably, yeah, like the distressed thing, and then the kind of, and it was in an incubator, and I was like not very well. And I think probably, yeah, I didn't bond. I wasn't breastfed. I was very like, yeah, it was cold, and I suppose, you know, looked after. I mean, my parents love me. I love them back. But I think probably, yeah, there's something in that kind of, you know, maybe very immediate separation. You know, my mother was so ill, she couldn't look after me, you know, for a long time. And then when I couldn't sleep, she also couldn't look after me because she was exhausted. And, you know, I think it's like the excess of the child's demand. It's not the child's fault either, but, you know, just to be permanently alert and awake. It's like a nightmare if you're a parent.
Not to mention for the child. it sounds like you entered into a battle zone right from day one, like of the birth itself. I mean, I had a difficult birth too, but not in that way. Like, my mother was drugged and I was drugged and all that. So kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, not to say that it's better. I just recently blogged something based on Dave O'Shana's last event, which seemed relevant right from the start when we were talking today, which is that he was talking about this idea of the original wound, is that we all have some primary wound, that, not to say we don't have other wounds afterwards, but there's like at the deepest, or the first wound is, the first cut is the deepest, is the Cat Stevens song, which is about love, isn't it? Unrequited love or requited love even. And that because of this wound, we get inverted, like the natural flow within us to give and receive love, it gets inverted. And we end up, because we're trying so desperately to get the thing that we didn't receive, the love and support and protection, that the lack of which causes the wound, that basic desire to receive love and to give love gets inverted, and so all of our attempts to get what we need push it away. So we're always, even though we're trying to get, the way we're trying to get pushes it away, because actually we don't want to re-experience the love, because then we risk re-experiencing the separation again, the wound all over again. So essentially we're isolating ourselves because of this wound as a way to feel safe, but there's something obviously deep within us that's still driving us to get the thing that we couldn't get to begin with. So it creates this terrible kind of dynamic where the harder we're trying to get the thing we need, the more we push it away. And I think this relates to how we try and succeed in the world. Essentially, we're driven by a need for love, and we're trying to get it in all the wrong places by all the wrong methods. And I mean, I've just been kind of discovering this with the campaign, because it's the first time I really felt like I was successful and was getting the validation I'd always failed to get in the past. And I think it was primarily because I wasn't looking for it anymore. I just wanted to publish the book, you know. I kind of forgot about all that other stuff because I've you know, found some level of peace. And then suddenly I'm like, gosh, I'm getting all this thing that I was looking for my whole life. So there definitely has been a long period for me of trying to get and failing and have been re-triggered time and time again, and just slowly embracing the failure and the frustration and the distress and the anguish of it, not in the sense of clinging to it, but just allowing it to be there and accepting it. and not converting it into shame, I suppose, to bring it back to the shame thing, as in not believing it when I say to myself there's something wrong with me, just accepting it, that that's the situation. I think it's allowed me to open up and to actually ask for what it is that I want and be able to receive it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting what you're saying. I mean, to me, it sounds like such a male position in a way. This, you know, almost like protecting, isolating oneself against the thing that you want or think you want. You know, and I think, you know, like in the book, or the text that I wrote, it's really the opposite problem. It's like this having this excess of affection and love that you want to give, you know, from the feminine position to somebody who can't or doesn't want it.
Right.
You know, and like that's in a way the problem, I think, for a lot of women, maybe. I mean, with very, you know, difficult men or a kind of men who I don't know, fear the withdrawal or the breaking of the bond and therefore don't enter into, you know, affectionate relationships. Whereas, I don't know, for me, it doesn't seem very difficult to be affectionate. Like, it doesn't feel like it costs me anything. It's like, I enjoy it, you know. It's like, it's very nice to be kind of kind and loving and, you know, but then it's sort of, yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether these are just kind of gendered positions or whether these are psychological positions. I mean, maybe it has to do, you know, like you're talking about writing and this need for validation. It's like, you know, I actually don't feel that as much as I think some other writers do. I take enormous pleasure from having constructed a good sentence for myself, you know, like my own self-enjoyment. It's quite onanistic, really. Like I had, when I was writing a blog a long time ago, I had a fantasy image of the ideal reader, which would be someone I didn't know sitting alone in a room, laughing at something I'd written. You know, this was like who I wrote for, but they weren't a real person, you know, of course, and they weren't kind of a big audience or anything like this. It was like the kind of, I wanted to replicate the self-enjoyment or like the almost, yeah, masturbatory like pleasure of writing a funny sentence, like in the fantasy other. And I wonder about this, yeah, this image of desire. Like I, in a way, I sort of know that I won't get validation from anybody, like that it would never work that way. It's like preemptively I know that, you know, there isn't another who is going to save me. Like no one is going to save anyone, right? In a way, all you can do is like amuse yourself, and I think that's my model.
Okay, so I'm interested in asking more about the specifics of the book, but now you've said something provocative again, so I have to go there. I used to believe that. I used to believe that no one can save anyone, but I qualified it. I said that it is possible to lead someone to a place where they can save themselves.
Yeah.
And now I think that's maybe just splitting hairs. Now I do feel that not only can we save each other, but we have to save each other. That's the only way it's going to work, is if, and this is back to this love, inverted love current within us, that it's only by really opening. And I do think what that male female thing, I think it's much more than gendered. I think it's energetic, it's yin yang, isn't it? There are going to be modalities that are more natural or more inbuilt to the female psyche or the male psyche, I think, but I don't think it necessarily makes it that different, because you're still, you're experiencing the pain of not being received. Maybe I'm receiving the pain of not being able to give, whatever, but it's still a two-way thing. The main thing is the pain of not being able to connect. And I think that we all feel in ourselves that we are lost, we're damned without those connections, and that the only way to save ourselves is to connect, and that sometimes that does entail finding someone who will save us, as in someone who is connected, and sometimes, or it's not either or, and it involves finding people we can save. Like there's this chain of souls that are disconnected, and we're all neurons in a brain. We're all, you know, floating around with amnesia, and until we actually find enough of who resonate at this frequency to remind us of what we are, and that, you know, we are resonators of love, that then we're lost. Anyway, that's my
it's very beautiful. I like the resonators of love. I mean, I should qualify what I said. I mean, of course, I think people can help each other, and that they the way they do, and they must, and you know, we are kind of I mean, you know, the person who the book is about was the person who intervened into my drinking as this kind of act of kindness. You know, and it was because, you know, he did that, and I was able somehow to latch on what I knew I had to do anyway, that was, you know, coming, because my life was destroyed, and my, you know, health was destroyed, and my work and everything was destroyed from my drinking. So, but somehow I latched onto his desire to want to help me. And it worked.
Right.
Then it creates, you know, kind of complexity, and then because somebody does this very kind gesture for you, not just a gesture, I mean a really serious and loyal and, you know, serious thing to do to somebody, you know, in a very life-changing way, you know, the complexity of untangling then the, like, one's gratitude, you know, my gratitude towards this person, with another feeling, which is kind of more on top of that, right? It's not just feeling grateful, it's also this recognition of the person, right? The loving this person in their uniqueness. You know, it's not simply a kind of, yeah, exchange of, you know, you did this kind thing for me. You know, because actually it's terrifying to be loved by somebody, really. It's not kind at all.
Well, was part of what happened for you that you found yourself experiencing yourself differently because this person was willing to try and save you, that it helped you to realize that you were worth saving?
Yes, I mean, I think so. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't think I was worth saving. It just, I suppose, it wasn't even a possibility. I was so far past the point of even thinking about being saved or not, you know, to have this other possible life presented to you, you know, really a second life, or, you know, as a possibility.
Through the intervention. So the two things got fused for you to some extent, as in the person, the individual himself, and the act of salvation. Sorry, Christian, of course. But the act of intervention, as in you were being given a second chance by the intervention of this person. So then it might have seemed as though your second life was centered around that person.
I think it's more complicated than that, or at least I want to say it is. But I've no doubt that that is part of it, for sure. And even the anguish of the loss of the relation to Dionysus, my mythological attempt to dignify what is actually a very undignified, you know, illness, if you want to call it that. I don't know. There's an obvious sense in which the structure of desire and one's libidinal economy, if you rewire it so dramatically, like simply stop the circuits that you were really deeply engaged in, you know, the latching onto something else is obviously an extremely common thing. It's not surprising. And I think, yeah, I mean, I had to think about that all the time, you know, this question of replacement. And of course, you can't replace a substance with a person, you know, or at least there's something incredibly dangerous about doing that. But no doubt there are kind of unconscious forces, like, trying to replicate, you know, like demons really trying to repeat or get hold of, you know, the same kind of like, I don't know, guilt and pain and suffering somehow. So you have to refuse all of those shadow copy demons.
There's two myths coming to mind while you're talking there. One was, first of all, it was Pluto. You know, Pluto and Persephone, you know that myth?
Which one is this one?
Persephone, the beautiful virgin daughter of the Demeter, who every man wanted, and she was too good for all the men, and then Pluto comes up from the underworld and drags her down to hell. Okay. And rapes her, and then makes her his queen. That's Pluto and Persephone. And then the other one was Orpheus and Eurydice, how you pronounce it, which is kind of the opposite. That's the god coming in to rescue her from the underworld. I don't know if any of these are useful at all, but the thing is, you brought up Dionysus, and you've got this mythological relationship, or you had this mythological relationship to the alcohol. Then I was wondering if you've thought about or found ways to frame your experience mythologically, as in your emergence from alcoholism.
Yes, I mean, for a long time in the first few weeks afterwards, I was kind of plagued with this vision of a kind of lake that was on fire, as if all of the alcohol was kind of burning off this lake. I mean, it was like a real vision I had repeatedly. And then the kind of waves of melancholy were also like these kind of, you know, huge clear water waves, right? Exactly corresponding to the amount I'd drunk and the destabilizing effect in a way. And I don't know, I mean, I was also engaged in like psychoanalysis for this 3-year period, so I guess about a year and a half before I stopped drinking, I was on the couch. And when I, well, no, I wasn't on the couch, after I stopped drinking I took the couch, and it was like a descent into the underworld. In fact, I had 6 dreams in 6 nights, and then on the 7th returned to the couch again. And there was this absolute, and I went blind temporarily in this kind of hysterical way, like I couldn't see for a week, and you know, my vision narrowed, and I could only use candles, and it was very, very weird. I mean, it's properly like inner experience, like something was going in. So I had to kind of go back down into the underworld. I mean, I think the figure of the interventionist or the intervener here is more Mercury or Hermes than Pluto.
The psychopomp, yeah.
Yeah, like a psychopomp, yeah, exactly. And I talk about that in the text, you know, this kind of question of whether, you know, I'm not already dead, and this person has been brought back from my life. I mean, it was someone I used to know who randomly reappeared, and then, you know, whether this person is actually here to collect me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thought that crossed my mind, you know, often in the first year, for sure.
Okay, so what would that mean? What would that change?
In a way, nothing. I mean, in the text, I end up kind of concluding that it wouldn't matter, you know, if it was a question of being alive or being dead. You know, and I think my feeling about death perhaps is like this, like I'm not afraid to die. And I think this is the philosophical position in a way, you know, for various reasons. I mean, almost because I kind of got as close as you probably can to it in certain ways through my own behavior and action. You know, I was very ill at the time I stopped. And yeah, and in that sense, then death, I don't know, is like lost its sting in a way. It's so I it doesn't matter to me if I'm actually alive or dead. It doesn't scare me.
Well, you know, we're dead for infinitely longer period than we're alive. So mathematically speaking, we must be dead.
Yeah.
because
also from a humanitarian, I mean, you know, if you think about the fact that we have the technology to kill everyone immediately, you know, or the heat death of the universe, I mean, speculatively, we are all of us already dead, and we always were dead, you know, and I talk about this in the text as well. I mean, from the standpoint of almost anything, you know, technology or time, we are dead, you know.
Well, so I wonder what the practical application of this is, because one can say that a million times, and what I said, you know, mathematically, if we calculate the odds, we must be dead now, because it's not feasible that we would be alive, seeing as our life is such a short span within eternity. That's an intellectual thing. It doesn't translate into, because we experience ourselves as alive, right? Well, whatever. One can come up with all these different models, like it's a simulation or eternal return and so on. But I'm not sure any of those help. Again, I had two thoughts and now I can't settle on either one. So I'll just grab the one I could remember, which is... it's not really the one I wanted to grab. I wanted to grab the other one. But anyway, it'll come to me, I'm sure. What if it has to do with that we're not alive in the way that we think we're alive? And if that has to do with... Well, this is my sense anyway. I can't try and twist it into a question, because you know, it might not mean much to you as a question, but... My sense is, oh, I know what the other thing was. Good, thank you, brain. The thing I'm afraid of isn't death. It's seeing the things that I'm afraid to see in life. And the knowing, the certainty, rightly or wrongly, that if I don't see those things while I'm alive, I'm going to have to look at them when I'm dead. And then I won't be able to change them or do anything about them. I won't be able to live with them because I'll be dead. Right, so I'm afraid of that, and that's tautological. I'm afraid of the things I'm afraid of, and I believe that's true of everybody who's still unconscious, who isn't enlightened, let's say, big word, but anyway. And to get to the other point that I did remember was my feeling about that is, you know, what to be enlightened is, or to be fully conscious is to realize that when we don't exist at all as individuals, that's all a big sham. It's a big matrix. We're one life force, all interconnecting and interrelating, with these particularly profound or strong connections that are localized. Yeah, but still, we're still part of one larger field of consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, this brings us back to Spinoza. That's kind of what he says too. It's like, you can see it from the standpoint of matter or see it from the standpoint of mind. It's the same thing. They're just two different attributes, two different ways of looking at the same thing. But yeah, in that sense, you know, we're part of substance. We're, you know, finite modes in this infinite kind of thing. and obviously this, like, you can talk about it in terms of like pantheism or, you know, a kind of panpsychism as well, you know, like mind is sort of everywhere and extending infinitely, and we are a kind of, yeah, a node in a small part of it in a way, but connected. Nevertheless, yeah, I mean, I was trying to think about the anything that I'm afraid of, and you know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but I can't actually think of anything. There's nothing that I'm afraid to see at this point. I mean, it's not always true, but...
Well, what makes you think you would know what... I mean, I'm not saying I know what is it, or in my case, I don't know if you've how much you read of Vice of Kings, but it's pretty much in there, but I pretty much know there's something in my childhood was absolutely terrifying. So supposing you were to relive your birth, for example. I mean, there's no way not to be afraid during that. You could say that you're not afraid of it happening, of doing that, but to experience it would be terrifying. It would have to be.
Maybe. I mean, I suppose I have this perhaps, you know, perhaps ridiculous thought that in a way all suffering is something, you know, it's, I don't know, that it's part of it somehow, you know, that every piece of suffering, every moment, I mean, it's sort of like the universe suffers through you. Like, I think there's a form of passive acceptance, which is to say, you know, the turbulence and the movements, you know, must, I don't know, be reenacted or acted through individuals, and that when one cries, one doesn't cry for oneself, and it's the universe crying through you, you know. And it sounds like you could see it as very arrogant, but I think it's the opposite. I think it's that there is this quantitative, you know, set of forces in a certain way, and they kind of, like the weather, you know, like pass through you, and you think, okay, there's an occasioning cause, right? I'm sad about this thing, you know, but sometimes it's sort of not even like that, you know. I mean, you could listen to a piece of music. I was listening to something this morning, and, you know, sort of, you know, like weeping at the kind of the beauty of the sound of the music, and it's like, who or what is crying in this moment? You know, it's not exactly me, you know, that, like, why am I crying exactly?
Sure. So, but that's not to say you wouldn't feel those feelings, even if you're not identifying with them.
No, but I suppose the knowledge is that they will pass, that anything that is painful will also end, you know, and that you can hold on to this thought even when you're suffering, you know, very badly, you know, even when you feel, you know, the worst you've ever felt, you know, that you know that it won't last, you know, even the weather won't stay the same.
Yeah. But my sense is of that, of becoming more of a clear, a body, you know, that's relaxed enough that emotions come through it and pass, and is that I feel things more intensely, not less. It's, but there's less suffering, but there's more pain. could put it that way, even if you want, right?
Well, I mean, then I don't know, perhaps it's also this initiatic question of how much one can take, you know. I'm like very interested in this idea of the ordeal pit, which is part of the Mithraic initiation, right? So they, you know, this is like a soldier cult. I mean, there aren't any women in, you know, Mithraic temples, right? But nevertheless, you have this Roman soldier cult, and they have kind of like a hazing ritual, right? So you have this kind of like coffin, the stone coffin, and they would put like ice in it or hot coals, and the whole point was to see how long you could stay in the ordeal pit, right? And it's called the ordeal pit. And in a way, it's a form of like initiatic training. So not only do you kind of ascend within the kind of cult, but also it's kind of, if you can take those extremes in these kind of conditions, then as a soldier, everything else you encounter is going to be less than something you've already experienced. So you already know how to handle like very extreme cold or very extreme heat, for example. So I think there's this kind of sense in which, maybe it's quite Blakeyan again, like if you've been in very excessive states, you know, like through drug use or whatever, or kind of just thinking, or, you know, been in very, very deranged or very excessive states, that anything less than that is kind of completely dealable with, you know. It's like, oh, well, it wasn't as bad as that time when I was, you know, like psychotic for a week or whatever. You know, it's like, brilliant. Like, even if you feel a bit bad, it's not as bad as like this other thing. So I think there's something kind of initiatic and, you know, about this kind of ordeal pit. And if you regard all these experiences as like forms of hazing, you know, sort
being
of
hazed by the universe.
Exactly.
Thank you.
I think we could get to Sacrifice here probably, because I think what you're describing is it presents a challenging dichotomy again, because I think, I mean, the example you gave, my interpretation of that, I mean, it's not that much different from going joining the Marines and being trained. I don't think that makes more wholesome, healthy human beings. I think that that kind of really intensified, and certainly hazing rituals don't, trauma application it leads to dissociation and desensitization, so you get people become numb, and then they can do. So that's at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, hopefully, is more like your experience and mine, which is there's a natural organic way that life itself does present us with opportunities for suffering that are will extend us outside of our comfort zone and give us the opportunity to relax and let go in difficult situations because of these early traumas. So it's not re-traumatizing, it's de-traumatizing, like it's re-experiencing the trauma in a situation where we're like, wait, all these strong feelings coming up, they're disproportionate to the stimuli, so I don't have to take them seriously, and yet they're still there in the body, and so then we let them come up and out. And so I think there's a spectrum there. It's not really a dichotomy or polarity, because there would be areas in between where it's just re-traumatization that just desensitizes us and makes us pathological, versus the increasingly conscious reenactment of an ancient trauma that resolves it. And the reason I thought we could bring it to Sacrifice is because you want to talk about Sacrifice, and I know that you, as well as I, have had some sort of proximity to the darker end of Sacrifice, as in ritual abuses and satanic, that kind of thing. When I say proximity, I don't mean directly necessarily, but just people who are involved in those things. So this is one end of the spectrum, which is clearly pathological and destructive. And then the other end of the spectrum, the positive sacrifice, such as you giving up alcohol to create a space for something else to come into. And well, I don't know, you can jump in at any time there if you want.
I suppose this is, one difference in the kind of forms of sacrifice might be, sacrificing to and sacrificing for, right? I mean, like sacrificing to, like, let's say a god or to something higher is a different thing than the kind of like sacrifice of oneself, or, you know, sacrificing somebody to, you know, like, it's yeah, I mean I think the in our culture we tend to think of the latter more than the former, you know, the sacrifice of, like, I gave up something for something else, whereas, you know, the kind of active sacrifice, we could say, let's say, like, the, you know, to do with the kind of recognition of the sacred. And in a way, that's what's kind of been disavowed and kind of displaced in our culture. But I think anthropologically it comes back. I think it's very difficult to, you know, totally rationally eliminate, you know, the role and the function that something like a scapegoat plays in religion. I mean, this is like René Girard's point. And I suppose I'm very interested in figures like Peter Thiel, who's very obsessed with René Girard, you know, and Peter Thiel's kind of investment in Facebook and social media. And he's written and spoken about the relationship between Girard's theory of sacrifice and social media. And there's some very interesting work on this where, you know, there's the kind of mimetic rivalry and mimetic desire of something like social media is in a way a way of controlling or dealing with the kind of violence that is latent basically all the time in humanity, you know, and Girard is obsessed with violence as this kind of constitutive, fundamental anthropological feature that religion, through the scapegoat mechanism, basically deals with or attempts to deal with, because instead of killing your neighbor at the last minute, you sacrifice something else as a stand-in for the kind of violence generated by rivalry and envy and all those sorts of things, which otherwise would tear society apart.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we don't have those religious mechanisms in the same way, but we do still have envy and rivalry and love and hate and all these other things. And, you know, there's a kind of argument some people make that someone like Peter Thiel and others, like, recognize that kind of fundamental anthropological claim of someone like Girard, and that social media is then a kind of mechanism for, mm-hmm. like, you know, almost like the virtualization of these kind of deep desires, right, for, by, you know, think about mobbing and cancelling and so on. So someone has suggested, I'm just going to check the name because I want to, like, reference this very interesting argument. Okay, there's a piece, I'm no longer find it, but there's a very interesting piece about Peter Thiel and Girard, in which the claim is that in order to protect the new gods, which are the Silicon Valley guys, that you have to kind of distract from the fact that actually you want to murder them, like they're the vulnerable ones, in a way. Yeah. So you get people to, like, virtually murder each other, you know, and this is what's actually going on. Girard says that the legal system, law, in a way, was supposed to replace religion in modernity, right? So you no longer need the religion to deal with these feelings. You have the legal system, you know, this rationalized system. But there's clearly a problem with that, because most people can't access the law, don't access, you know, the legal system is not a kind of readily available replacement for religion, right? It doesn't have the you know, I don't know, the spread, if you like, that religion does. You know, you can't just go to the law whenever, I mean, some people go to the law whenever they want, but, you know, it doesn't quite work in the same way to deal with these kind of fundamental tendencies. So then social media comes in as this sort of, like, third replacement, right, between religion, law, and then this thing, the virtual arena. I think you can see it constantly, this kind of, like, rivalry, urge to destroy, you know, mob behavior. But the idea, I suppose, is to some extent, it doesn't matter because it's not real, even where there are material effects on people's lives,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there's something virtualized about the consequences of online violence. You know, and that these kind of new gods are not seen then. They're the kind of puppet masters dealing with this force that they recognize, this kind of libidinal, you know, current, you know, and they're protected from it. I'm just going to find the name of the article, because it was really quite good.
Okay.
Okay, it's by Jeff Schullenberger, and it's on cyborgology, and it's called Mimesis, Violence, and Facebook, Peter Thiel's French Connection. And it's a very, very good and, I think, deep, thorough piece about how Girard functions for Peter Thiel based on things that Thiel has said, and how this plays out in something like Facebook and other social media.
Hmm. I wonder what Girard would think. He's just died, didn't he?
Hmm.
I mean, it raises many questions, what you said, but the last one that came to me was this, how tricky it can be to, you know, make profound discoveries such as Girard did, presumably knowing that they can then be applied for social engineering purposes, crowd control, and so on. And that seems to be in what happened. And of course, Girard also famously said that when there's a global village, it will just take one match to set the whole thing afire. So social networking, on the one hand, you're suggesting it's a kind of solution or way to manage large populations, but on the other hand, it's making, it's connecting ever larger populations so that it's harder and harder to manage, that the risk of mimetic violence is increasing constantly. And I mean, I suppose part of the solution may be here, and this is something I've written about maybe in the last chapters of Maps of Hell. Certainly I've written about the technological the effects of technology in society and the media, and that people are becoming more and more disembodied or less and less embodied because they're living and expressing through the technology. On the one hand, this is giving people the opportunity to express their ids and their unconscious, so yeah, they can take out all of their rage and envy and discontent on each other and feel that it's not real, and on the other hand, or at the same time, they're becoming less and less possibly, you know, connected to or aware of the physiological reality of these things. So certainly in terms of violence and hostility, you know, a tweet or a Facebook thing, they're not feeling the consequences, but even in terms of not necessarily experiencing it in their bodies as much as they were, because they're projecting into these avatars. Of course, video games, was, you know, before social media, there was video games. We know that video games are used as military training, and part of the trick there is you get people to get so used to killing people as a game that when they move to killing in real life, it's still just a game because they got the drones and all the rest of it. So there's no moral consequences. Right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, Girard is a, you know, Catholic thinker, and he's on the side of peace in a way. He's identifying these kind of currents in order to suggest that we need to, like, always think about ways of you know, stopping the spiral, you know, because this kind of mimetic quality of violence is always that it increases, you know, like it's a tit for tat thing. You know, someone says something nasty about you say something nasty about them, you know, the escalation problem.
Yeah.
You know, and this is like, then you need something to kind of cut the escalation. I mean, you know, I think, I mean, again, a bit glibly, but I mean, you know, if the internet was pulled tomorrow, you know, if suddenly somehow the whole military apparatus of it collapsed, you know, what would the world be like? You know, it's very interesting to think about. You know, people would have to return to a world that's not that long ago, really. I mean, I didn't use the internet until I was 18. So I had an entire childhood. I'm the last generation, you know, Gen X, that didn't have the internet as a child. And, you know, and then the internet was like not very good for years. It wasn't really a big part of anyone's life, particularly, you know, didn't have to be. And your world was the people you met and the books you randomly encountered and this kind of thing, you know, and it was a smaller world in a way, but kind of maybe a more meaningful world. Also a world of boredom, you know, like kind of very beautiful boredom. But I mean, there were always, you know, forms of media. I mean, like, you know, when I couldn't sleep, I was just obsessed with the radio, and I'd listen to the radio for 22 hours a day. You know, so it's not like there's this kind of pre-technological, you know, garden. where we were all living.
It's a long time ago, anyway. I was just
Quite.
thinking today, God, what? Maybe I should just do a day without words. Like, how would that be? I mean, not just not speaking, because they do this on Vipassana, but even on Vipassana, you hear somebody telling you what to do. So yeah, for me to spend a whole day, so I wouldn't listen to any audios, wouldn't read, wouldn't write, wouldn't talk, that would be quite a challenge for me. And for me, it very much does come down to words. Like the original technology is language, and it's the original, it's there at the Garden of Good and Evil. And it's in our childhood we learn language, and part of the way we learn language, we're punished for doing bad and we're rewarded for doing good, even if there's no coherence, as in my childhood, it was just, crazy alcoholic mother. It was all random, really, but still, it was the imprint, right? The language imprint, which is also apparently how the satanic ritual abuse or mind control, they combine trauma with language. We get the language embedded in our nervous system, and then it controls us internally. That seems to be the thing that's possessing us. And social media and the internet seems to be just the latest iteration of that evolution.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, like I joke all the time about like writing was a mistake, you know what I mean? Those like very early forms of technology, you know, in a way, like the moment someone with a stick on the ground, you know, not Diogenes, but one of his peers, you know, starts to diagram something or then we're in trouble. I mean, then we're here immediately. This is very like the 2001 scene, but it is that's what is always going to happen the moment you start with the stick on the ground. And you know, or tool use, and you know, it's like this. And in a way, you can say there's nothing you can do about it. It's inevitable. In fact, it's part of our human nature to use tech, you know, to be technological, right? That is our nature. It's our nature to always push at the boundaries of innovation. You know, that's not unnatural. You know, we seem to have created like a artificial world, but in a way, that's a natural outpouring or you know, function of our own natures. But yeah, I mean, to go back to the fear of death point, at one point, a long time ago, perhaps when I was in my 20s, I did have this panicked fear of death. And it was precisely on the basis of the thought that there would be no more words. And that this thought terrified me in the moment when I thought this thing. And it was something to do with Beckett, actually. I was reading a lot of Samuel Beckett at this time. And this thought actually was the one thought that genuinely caused fear. Me, that there would be no more words.
Interesting. The matrix collapses. It's just us and the infinite.
But now maybe there have been enough words, you know, I said many words.
Well, I'm tempted to end there, but I think it's too soon. Well, we're getting close to 2 hours. I always
My
like to
God, really?
end on a punchy point. But no, I think there's still more to be said, of course. I mean, what you just said there was very interesting. I mean, the words being this buffer, and matrix means womb, like we've created this second womb. And also, you've reintroduced this question of what is human nature and what's natural? Is nature all there is? And if so, how can we separate ourselves from it? And also, I'll pluck up a thought I never got to articulate earlier, which is this idea, this kind of current secular drive to separate us from nature, or even imagine that we can be. Does seem to a way to reify humans again in the absence of God. So there's something there going on whereby we've stripped nature and reality from the context of God, and we've had to replace God with ourselves. I forgot where I was going with that now. But certainly, language is the thing that we do best. Oh, it was the counterfeit. Yeah, I mean, at what point does the counterfeit or the copy? I guess it doesn't start as a counterfeit, does it? It says sort of that first diagram or that first word. It starts innocently enough, it seems, anyway. But at a certain point, the map becomes so fascinating that we forget but it represents the territory, and we're just staring at the map. So then, yeah, what was a copy becomes a counterfeit.
It is about forgetting, though. I mean, Derrida and other people make this point, you know, the invention of writing is a way of writing things down so you don't forget. But the point is, then the writing creates forgetting.
Right.
You know, so we right. forgot the fact that we, you know, so there's another idea in the Greek tragedy is Greek culture's way of dealing with the trauma of writing. Because suddenly you have this technology that permits voices to be heard when there's no one there, which is literally schizophrenic, you know, in the sense of like breaking one's mind or breaking one's heart even. You know, the if there's no separation between the mind and the heart in a way, you have an entire culture that is suddenly traumatized by this technology because it creates like ghosts. You know, you can read something or some people can read something and the person who wrote it isn't there. So you create time, you create this new concept of time, and you also create this absence, this kind of haunted voice, you know, a voice without a body. What is a voice without a body?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then the writing, yeah, then becomes like, you know, this form of forgetting. It's the technology of forgetting precisely because it's supposed to remember. Because if you had confidence in what you were saying and you felt you spoke, you know, if you like always honestly or freely, why would you need to write anything down? You know, if you could trust your own mind or if you could trust an oral culture, you could trust someone else to remember, or maybe you didn't need words that much. You know, maybe you would live in a kind of more entheogenic spiritual way, you know, in which you were responding to the spirits of every place you were in, you know. And one of the tenses that gets lost in classics is the locative, which is the idea that the tense changes depending on what place you are, you know. We never use the locative now, you know. It's like why would we need to talk about the field spirit at 12 p.m. or, you know, like the bird spirit at 1:30 p.m. You know, not that they thought it like this, but you know, like that question of space and time has become the matrix of the map. It's like, you know, these kind of very formal structures that are non-specific, non-special in a way, purely quantitative.
So the days of the week also named after the planets. So like originally they were markers to remind us of the planetary bodies, perhaps. So I was wondering, or it occurred to me rather, that because this always comes back to, you know, is the, you're saying the technology is traumatizing, and I would say yes, but it's re-traumatizing, that the technology is a symptom of trauma. So then language perhaps is a symptom of trauma as well. So then it's, then perhaps it has to do with the moment at which we began to disconnect, or that signals that wasn't the forgetting, it was the need to remember. Why do we why do we ever have this need to hold on to experience and to store it?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess you have the idea of anamnesis in Plato. All life is a process of recovering memories, the things we once knew in their perfection in a way, and you know that we're in this fallen state and that we're gathering kind of memories in order to return to like this memory that we once had.
Yeah.
I mean, but I mean from a sort of Lacanian point of view, like every child's entry into language, everybody's entry into language is traumatic. Like there is no nice neutral way of entering into language. And Chris Deva and others talk about almost observationally, like in child development, that before, like in the weeks leading up to when the child speaks, they become very sad. Mm-hmm. You know, that there is almost like a knowledge that they kind of have to speak, and that this is like actually incredibly upsetting.
Yeah.
You know, and that your entry into language, I mean, you could say it's either neurotic or psychotic or perverse, you know, like.
Well, probably because it's the only way to connect. I mean, that's something I viscerally began to realize about my childhood, even though I barely remember it, was that I was wandering, staggering, flailing around, trying to connect to the family organisms, and they weren't there. They were alcoholics, they were drunk, they were traumatized, and they were in you know, this headspace, this very tight, narrow bandwidth of the mind, of the language, and that was the only, you know, the only way that there was to communicate. And I actually did really, I took to language like a fish to water once I got through that initial splitting process, which I don't remember, but I became very eloquent as a child, and my eloquence was a way to be received and be loved. Like, I was particularly appreciated by my father, particularly because of how eloquent I was. So yeah, I don't even remember what you're describing, but I can easily agree that I went through that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the obvious thing that's kind of lost between sort of birth and like entry into language, as it were, would be something like touch. Mm. You know, I mean, touch is this kind of form of connection, which is, you know, you could say pre-linguistic in some ways, not pre-symbolic, but it's sort of, you know, it, like you say, like, so you use language to connect, but it's also distance.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's, you know, you're no longer in the embrace or the hug or the, you know, you no longer have the breast in your mouth if you were breastfed.
I wasn't.
No, nor me. But yeah. I think there might be some interesting relation then between being kind of like hyperlinguistic or literary or eloquent or, you know, reading early and these sorts of things, maybe, you know, because it is another way of like trying to connect, perhaps, you know, mm-hmm. you didn't in the first place. You know, it's just a very, very spontaneous hypothesis.
Well, let's bring it back to your book then, as we have to be winding up anyway. And your book is a cri de coeur, a cry from the heart. Huh? So, I wouldn't go so far, I haven't read all of it, to say that it's a cry for love. It's not crying out, love me only, but that's in there, isn't it? That is in there.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose at the end I asked this question about writing, actually. You know, who am I writing it for? Am I writing it for this person? Am I writing it for myself? Am I writing it just for the sake of writing? Like, it becomes completely unclear to me at the end. And I wrote it in this kind of 7-day period where I was insomniac and jet lagged and having to travel around and in this quite like delirious state.
So you're reliving your childhood experience.
No doubt. Always.
Yeah. Carry on, I interrupt you anyway.
I think it, yeah, becomes like self-referential. I mean, yeah, I think it's very heartfelt text. Like I say, when I wrote it, I felt like I couldn't do anything else. It's like the only thing I could think to do. You know, I had to go and give some talks and do other things in this state of, you know, really advanced insomnia at this point and kind of heartbreak and separation and confusion, you know, and then this was it. This was the only thing I could do. So it was like compelled or compulsive writing, which isn't my normal relation to writing at all. I write all the time, but it's, you know, a much more structured way. You know, it's like a job.
Normally.
Yeah.
Do you feel any apprehension about how it's going to be received, or have you made your peace with
made
the world? You have. Yeah. The sun won't read it, you know that. Unless it's...
No.
Over somebody's shoulder, perhaps.
I don't think many people will read it. I mean, it's quite short. It's like it should be quite beautifully designed. Like, Lewis does these really pretty books. But yeah, I mean, I really don't think it will, you know, be read by very many people. But that's also quite good in a way. It's like, you know, I've written some very public online type statements, and this is not that. You know, this is not a online declaration or confession or whatever. This is something outside of that, to some extent.
So you're hoping at least that one person will read it?
No, he has already read it.
Okay.
I think he's flattered.
I imagine that he would be. It's testimony. Yeah, testimony.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, we'll see.
All right. Well, I got to go to work in a minute, so I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to.
That was fairly comprehensive. That was a lot more analytic and personal in a way than I had imagined.
Oh, you mean psychoanalytic?
Yeah.
Right. Because I
was
think
quite
you're.
deep.
Well, we aim for the deep, of course. It's the only direction to go in.
Apparently.
Yeah, well, I was aware of there were ways it could have gone a lot deeper, but I didn't want to turn it into a session that kind. And
Another time.
yeah, maybe or maybe not. And we didn't get to your troubles with dark forces either, but maybe that's a thing of the past now.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I think so. I'm on the side of light.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul.
That's the end of my conversation with Nina Power. If you want to find out more about her and her work and her new book, follow a link in the show notes. Next week's conversation is a long-awaited return talk with Sheldon Solomon. I'm just finishing up the final draft of 16 Maps of Hell. It's gone through some radical and radically surprising changes at this last pass. Really unexpected how much I must have changed to find that the book, as I thought was ready for publication, simply was not up to scratch. But I'm very excited about what I'm discovering in this last reworking. Feels as though there was a secret subtext there which even I hadn't realized, and of course very close to home. And I think the book is transforming nicely into what I hoped it would be, a kind of capstone on the pyramid of my sociocultural engineering opus so far. Well, the end of it, the exit from hell. So if you haven't already, and even if you have, maybe pre-order another copy of that, help me fund the hardback edition before August the 8th, 2020.
Change with the night, strangers in the heart, stay up until light, dangers in your soul.